Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. This week we present Ken Klippenstein, The Nation magazine's Washington, D.C. correspondent, who talks about an internal memo we obtained, which details the Trump regime's deployment of federal agents to Portland, Oregon, to suppress racial justice protesters. Sarah Deer, a member of the Muskogee Nation, and a lawyer and professor at the University of Kansas, who reflects on the importance of the recent landmark Supreme Court ruling in the McGirt versus Oklahoma case for indigenous nations' territorial rights, and Andrew Lawrence of Media Matters for America, who summarizes his group's recent investigation that found Fox News continues to promote lethal coronavirus disinformation. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Amid escalating U.S.-China tensions, Trump regime Secretary of State Mike Pompeo blasted Beijing's maritime claims in the South China Sea as completely unlawful. Pompeo cited a 2016 ruling by an international tribunal in The Hague rejecting China's claim of historic reach in the vital sea lane as a violation of the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. For months, Southeast Asian nations have complained about Beijing's territorial claims in the waters off the coasts of Vietnam and Malaysia. In June, the U.S. Navy sent warships on maneuvers into the disputed waters of the South China Sea for what they called freedom of navigation exercises. In late June, officials from Vietnam and the Philippines warned of growing insecurity within Southeast Asia because of China's aggressive military maneuvers around the disputed Spratly and Paracel Islands. The area is rich with untapped fossil fuel reserves and fisheries. Beijing blasted Pompeo's speech on the South China Sea, accusing the Trump administration of being a troublemaker. China also imposed sanctions against U.S. military contractor Lockheed Martin for selling Patriot surface-to-air missiles to Taiwan. China claims an area in the South China Sea the size of Mexico. The Chinese embassy in Washington said in a statement that the U.S. government exaggerates the situation in the region and attempts to sow discord between China and its neighbors. The Trump administration has been selective in its endorsement of international rulings from The Hague and warned last month that international investigators looking into charges of war crimes by Americans in Afghanistan would face economic penalties and travel restrictions. When Mexico's populist president Andrés Manuel López Obrador, known as AMLO, ran for president, he derided Donald Trump and pledged to send a peaceful civilian army to confront U.S. troops at the border. However, since taking office, Obrador has largely cooperated with the Trump regime, including negotiating a new NAFTA trade deal and sending Mexican troops to block migrants crossing into the U.S. from their northern border. Obrador's first foreign trip was to the White House in early July to sign the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, where he dined with Trump and members of Mexico's business elite, including telecom billionaire Carlos Slim. This, in contrast to Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's decision to skip the signing ceremony just 4 months before the U.S. election. While in Washington, AMLO thanked Trump for being increasingly respectful toward Mexicans living in the U.S. It's as if the Mexican president suffered amnesia in not remembering when, 5 years ago, Trump labeled Mexican immigrants as rapists and drug dealers. Arizona Congressman Raul Grijalva dismissed AMLO's White House visit as a photo op and a slap in the face of Mexicans, Mexican Americans, and those seeking asylum. AMLO, he said, has become nothing more than Trump's collaborator. In the late 1960s, riots and militant protests in dozens of U.S. inner cities led to swift reforms, including the Federal Fair Housing Act, which overturned racist Jim Crow laws. Today, the epidemic of police violence targeting people of color is the focus of national and international attention after the murder of George Floyd by a white police officer in Minneapolis. Widespread anger unleashed a new multiracial movement demanding justice under the banner of Black Lives Matter. As the toxic legacy of American slavery is exposed, the issue of reparations is once again a topic of debate. Recent polls now find that 70% of white Americans view racial discrimination as a big problem. It's been over 150 years since slavery officially ended in the United States, but African Americans remain the most segregated group in the U.S. and are five times more likely than whites to live in high poverty neighborhoods. After the Civil War, during the Reconstruction era, Union General William Tecumseh Sherman issued an order in 1865 calling for the distribution of formerly Confederate land divided into 40-acre lots to be distributed to former slaves in South Carolina and Georgia. But after Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, President Andrew Johnson, a Southerner, overturned the order. Land went back to former slave owners, ending the only real attempt at reparations to benefit former slaves. In 1881, abolitionist Frederick Douglass observed, "When our slaves were emancipated, they were sent away empty-handed, without money, without friends, and without a foot of land on which they could live and make a living." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Following the May 25th police murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, protests calling for an end to police violence targeting communities of color swept the country. Portland, Oregon, with a long history of street activism, has seen more than 50 consecutive days of mostly peaceful protests, along with some vandalism and property destruction. However, in recent weeks, mass camouflage federal officers, without identification or badges, began arresting Portland protesters. In one confrontation with this federal force on July 10th, a peaceful protester, 26-year-old Donovan LaBella, suffered a fractured skull and required facial reconstructive surgery after he was struck in the head by impact munitions fired by an armor-clad officer. Oregon's governor and Portland's mayor have demanded the federal force leave the state. On July 17th, the U.S. Attorney for the Oregon District called for an investigation into these federal agents deployed by Customs and Border Protection and the Department of Homeland Security, who've been seen on video recordings, arresting protesters and putting them into unmarked SUVs. Your reporter spoke with Ken Klippenstein, the Nation magazine's Washington, D.C. correspondent, who talks about an internal memo he obtained, which details the Trump regime's coordinated program of domestic counterinsurgency that began in Portland. But according to the president, this same federal force will soon be deployed to other U.S. cities.
Chad Wolf, who is head of Department of Homeland Security, which contains within it Customs and Border Protection, he has said that even though the mayor of Portland and a bunch of municipal figures, along with two U.S. senators from Oregon, have said they don't want this support, he said, too bad, we're going to do it anyways. And that has been, you know, caused a lot of resentment, I would imagine, on the part of Oregon government and Oregonians. But also confusion as to, you know, if the locale isn't asking for the assistance, why on earth are they sending it? So what was given to me from a source of mine within the Department of Homeland Security was a memo describing sort of the length and scope and locations that this program, where they're sending these federal agents to assist with law enforcement, what those details are. And what the memos show is that this is being done pursuant to President Trump's executive order a couple weeks ago about protecting the national monuments. You all remember when that was a big story. So that's sort of where it is drawing its authority from. And in response to that executive order by President Trump, the Department of Homeland Security established what is called the Protecting American Communities Task Force, or PACT for short. So under this PACT task force, they are providing federal agents to assist with local law enforcement in response to perceived unrest or that kind of thing. And one of the big problems with this is, according to the memo, it says that they will be deployed for an unspecified period of time at an unspecified location and with drones ready and waiting should their assistance be needed. So they haven't ruled out the use of drones. That's another big issue, because you remember in Minneapolis during the George Floyd protest, there was a big public outcry in response to the use of a Predator drone to, you know, what seemed like surveil demonstrators there. So unfortunately, we have a profound lack of information from the administration about what exactly their goals are, how long this will last, and indeed, what cities exactly will be deployed to, because there's no indication that this will be limited to Portland. And in fact, there have been hints that this program will be expanded to other cities.
Ken, I did want to ask you about the Democratic Party, which controls the House of Representatives, and their response to this secret, unaccountable federal force that's in Portland and may be descending on other cities.
Well, one constructive thing that happened, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's office reached out to me after my report and showed me a bit of legislation they were working on to require that, you know, every federal agent is not only has their, you know, last name clearly emblazoned on their uniform, but also the agency that they work with. I think that's a constructive proposal. You know, I don't want to be too harsh on them because it's limited what they can do when they're facing the, you know, force of the federal government. So what is Congress doing? I would say not enough, generally. One thing, the major power that Congress has in situations like this is the power of the purse strings, especially when we have the National Defense Authorization Act coming up for passage soon. They could very easily be suspending or cutting or, you know, doing something to send the message to DHS that they need to get their act together, because that is the major power that they have. And even just at the committee level, they could be doing these things, regardless of how the Senate might vote.
I've been surprised by some of the very strong language that I've heard from Oregon senators and other commentators and politicians in general, who are referring to what's going on in Portland, Oregon. In some cases, they've said it's the leading edge of a fascist crackdown on the Trump regime's opponents. I'm not sure where you come down on that, but how do you gauge how serious to take this? Is this just an election year stunt, or is this something that poses a more serious threat to our democracy?
Well, this is something I thought about a lot. I think the distinction between authoritarian spectacle and then, you know, sort of genuine authoritarian practice sort of breaks down at a certain point, as we see with a number of authoritarian regimes. Things that, you know, maybe sort of media exercises or storytelling can very easily spill into actual policy and practice. So it may be, you know, all of the above. It may be just optics. But the tendency of something like this, these things can spin out of control very quickly. Just to do a sort of thought experiment, suppose that, you know, there is a terror attack in Portland because people are angry and feel as though they're being occupied by feds that don't really have any right to be there. Well, then I would imagine that the Trump administration would be under a lot of pressure to come down even harder, and that can escalate out of control. So even if it is just a practice in optics, I do think that could very easily escalate into something far more serious.
That was Ken Klippenstein, The Nation magazine's Washington, D.C. correspondent. Find a link to his piece titled, "The Border Patrol Was Responsible for an Arrest in Portland," and other related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On July 9th, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 5-4 in a case that indigenous people and their advocates are calling the most important in at least half a century. The decision held that the eastern half of Oklahoma is part of the Muscogee Creek Reservation, with major implications for indigenous tribes' legal jurisdiction. However, the ruling does not mean property owners in that part of the state will lose their land. The case, McGirt v. Oklahoma, was brought by a Native man convicted of sexually abusing a 4-year-old girl on reservation land. He was convicted in state court and sentenced to 1,000 years in state prison. The Supreme Court ruling will not likely result in the freeing of the convicted man, but rather would transfer his case to a federal court for retrial. The High Court ruling has important implications for 4 other tribes in Oklahoma, including the Cherokee, the Seminoles, the Choctaws, and Chickasaws. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Sarah Deer, a member of the Muscogee Creek Nation, a lawyer, and professor of Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies and Public Affairs and Administration at the University of Kansas. Here she reflects on the importance of the case for indigenous nations' jurisdictional rights and federal law.
There is no change in land ownership. In other words, this idea that, you know, the tribe is going to be able to take land away from white people or somehow upend you know, the role of the state in every day-to-day business, that none of that changes. It is a change in the conception of a reservation is different and distinct from actually Indian land. And I think that's why it's so confusing for a lot of folks.
You and others have said this Supreme Court decision is the most important for Indian rights in many decades. Why?
Absolutely. Because in this decision, the court was very clear that in order for a reservation to go away or be disestablished, it has to be done by Congress and it has to be done explicitly. Now, the Supreme Court has upheld all kinds of treaty abrogations over the years. But when they've done that, they've said here, Congress specifically articulated the end of that treaty. Because the United States has not opted out of our treaty, it still exists. And so that has implications for any treaty tribes, right, that are trying to assert their authority on the reservation or on the Indian land they've been promised. It has potentially impact for many, many different tribes, not just those in Oklahoma.
Neil Gorsuch, a conservative member of the court appointed by Donald Trump, joined the four liberal justices in this ruling, and he actually wrote the decision.
And, you know, it's interesting because the whole issue of sort of liberal versus conservative justices actually doesn't play out when it comes to Indian country, interestingly enough. So Ruth Bader Ginsburg has authored some really problematic decisions that affected tribal nations. And then we have someone like Gorsuch, and even Clarence Thomas about 4 years ago wrote a unanimous decision supporting tribal interests. So it's not easy to predict how the justices will vote on these cases.
I've spoken to professors at the Yale Law School who are experts in Indian law. Since Native Americans are citizens of their own 500-plus federally recognized tribes, but also citizens of the U.S., jurisdictional issues are very complicated, aren't they?
It's very, very complicated. It takes at least a semester in law school to fully get your head wrapped around it. And the reason it's so confusing is because the United States has changed its perspective on tribal sovereignty over time. So starting in the 1930s, the United States had a policy of helping tribes develop their own governments with constitutions. Then in the 1950s, the goal was to terminate tribal nations and actually do away with the separate identity. And then again in the late 60s and early 70s, the United States returned to a policy of self-determination. So when you have those different policies over time and laws are passed and not repealed, you end up with a very confusing spectrum of jurisdiction. It also differs from state to state. So it's very difficult to sort of know exactly what the ramifications of something are going to be because it plays out so differently, sort of depending on where you are, depending on the treaties, and depending on how the federal government has interpreted those treaties.
Professor Sarah Deer, you have said that tribal sovereignty is the key to protecting indigenous people from violence. How so?
Yeah, I think that tribal nations are in the best position to make decisions about how to keep their citizens safe. Now, that doesn't mean that every tribe does that, right? We have problematic states that don't protect their citizens very well and don't protect people from police brutality very well, right? So there's not a, it's not assuming that tribal nations are going to be the, you know, the experts in how to do this, but we can work as tribal citizens within our tribal governments to make changes that will better protect our community where we don't really have the ability to do that, you know, through the state or through the federal government, but we can do that as a sovereign nation.
Well, federal as well as the state's approach to criminal justice leaves a lot to be desired in terms of human rights violations and high recidivism rates. Are there other models out there in Indian country?
I think it's going to depend on the tribal nation, but yes, there is a lot of discussion among tribal attorneys that replicating Western law and order is certainly fraught. And there are many tribes that do operate sort of a Western law and order. It would, you know, a tribal court sort of looks like a state court, sounds like a state court, but they're applying tribal law. But there are other tribes that still maintain their traditional methods of dispute resolution. And so in cases, you know, maybe not in a child sex abuse case, but in cases where you've got drug abuse or you have juveniles that are not going to school, you know, some of those things, you know, we don't need to be punitive about some of those things. And the tribal nation might have a better approach to people's struggles than the state court system.
Is there anything else you think our listeners should know about this very important decision?
People might want to know a little bit more about how, you know, the decision affects civil jurisdiction. You know, it was about criminal law, but recognizing or reaffirming, rather, a reservation boundary also has implications potentially for Indian child welfare cases and for some civil jurisdiction questions. The implications aren't entirely clear since the case focused on criminal law, but there's going to be a lot of effort to address the question of civil jurisdiction.
That was Sarah Deer, a member of the Muscogee Creek Nation, a lawyer and professor at the University of Kansas. For more analysis and commentary on the landmark McGirt versus Oklahoma Supreme Court ruling, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Recent studies by Harvard University's Kennedy School Misinformation Review, the National Bureau of Economic Research, and the University of Chicago found that infection and mortality rates for the coronavirus are higher in areas where Fox News reaches the most viewers. This comes as the daily number of COVID-19 infections and deaths are increasing at an alarming rate. Together, these studies provide statistical analysis confirming that conservative media outlets like Fox, Rush Limbaugh, and other right-wing spun news and commentary programs disseminate misinformation about the threat posed by the COVID-19 pandemic. The views expressed on these outlets often repeat President Trump's talking points that dangerously contradict guidelines issued by public health officials, while dissuading many audience members from adopting protective measures such as wearing masks, maintaining social distancing, and observing stay-at-home orders. Your reporter spoke with Andrew Lawrence, Deputy Director of Rapid Response at Media Matters for America. Here he discusses his group's new report titled, Fox News Pushed Coronavirus Misinformation 253 Times Between July 6th and 10th, which adds to the earlier studies that examine the relationship between right-wing media and the spread of the coronavirus.
This was only over the course of 5 days. We had 253 different instances. And this goes from everything. Fox News, they try to separate their programming into opinion shows versus real news shows. And they tout the real news shows for actually giving information to people and for not being as biased. But we found that they were actually sharing a lot of misinformation that just wasn't true. So, and the thing is, with this snapshot in time, July 6th through 10th, there was a lot of talk about reopenings and masks and stuff like that. But it changes what they attack. It just kind of changes week to week. I mean, I've seen them. I saw Tucker Carlson, who's the face of the franchise at this point for Fox News, say that not only do lockdowns not work, but they actually help spread the virus. There's just no evidence for anything like that. And now what they're on right now is just the masks. They're convinced that masks not only don't help, but will make people sicker. And again, there's just no evidence for this. And the president, the president listens to them, and it puts all of us in danger when we do this. But I think just the sheer number, 253 different pieces of misinformation over a five-day period was just really stunning. And a lot of this misinformation comes from politicizing recommended public health measures that have come down from the CDC or Dr. Fauci or really anyone else, as if it doesn't align with their current worldview. And then there's a lot of stuff about reopening schools right now as well, just kind of brushing aside the public health concerns that everybody has and just sort of brushing it aside. And it's sort of the same thing that they did with reopening the economy. It was just sort of like, let's just do it and not take any precautions, really. And that's what's so scary, because I think that, most people want schools to reopen. Everybody wants the economy reopened, and they want to be able to leave their house and go on vacation. But you want to be able to do it safely. And that's where the frustration comes in, is that there's just no plan to do these things safely, because they're just not concerned with that. What this sort of stems from is that the right and conservatives, Republicans, and especially Trump just sort of got it in their head that the economy was going to be how they were going to win in 2020. That was how they were going to beat Joe Biden. And so that's all they're fixated on. Whereas things change, the circumstances change. And, I really feel like Trump would be doing an awful lot better in the polls right now, had he focused on actually beating this thing. And I mean, you look at what other countries have done, the way that they brought the curve down to almost zero, and they're essentially back to normal at this point. And that's what's so frustrating. So, you know, their economy is starting to get back up and going again. I saw South Korea is like down to 4-3% unemployment right now. And we're just still in the midst of this and nobody knows what to do. There's no leadership. And it's and again, you know, the president is taking his cues from this network, this conservative news network that is just trying to tell him what he wants to hear, I guess. It's confusing as to why they are doing it. But it's absolutely happening, and we're seeing the results. I mean, 130,000, I think we might have passed 140,000 dead people, dead Americans at this point. So it's really frustrating. It's really harming this country. I mean, there's just no doubt about it.
One avenue for holding Fox News and other outlets that are part of this right-wing coronavirus disinformation echo chamber is through their advertisers. In your report, you note that Amazon, Kraft, Heinz, Verizon, and other large corporations sponsor advertising on Fox News during these programs where disinformation is disseminated. What can be said about holding these companies accountable? Is a boycott part of an agenda that would be at all constructive at this point?
It may be the only recourse available to to people that are concerned about this type of thing. And, you know, we have seen success with things like that in the past. But, you know, I remember when Glenn Beck was on Fox News, when he got booted off the air, it was because he lost advertisers. His ratings were still up, but he got booted because he lost advertisers. Now, Fox News has sort of dug their heels in a little bit with that. I mean, Tucker Carlson currently, because of all of his racism, he doesn't have any advertisers. It's mostly Fox News promos and a couple MyPillow ads here or there. He doesn't have any advertisers, but I think Fox News just has dug in their heels and they don't want to feel bullied around. And so, you know, at that point, they've got to be losing money on that show in particular. But they keep them on air almost out of spite, it seems like. So it becomes very frustrating when you don't know what the recourse is, but all you can do is keep pushing forward and keep pointing it out.
That was Andrew Lawrence, Deputy Director of Rapid Response at Media Matters for America. Find a link to their new report titled Fox News Push Coronavirus Misinformation 253 Times between July 6th and 10th and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Progressive Voices Network, KTWH in Two Harbors, Minnesota, KMUD in Garberville, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.